Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are here tonight as long as, well, Texas and Jeff survives the heavy Monday rainstorm that could possibly affect his internet, but if not, here we are. What is going on, everybody? What's up, Jeff? What is up, Dennis?
Oh, man. Well, like I told you guys earlier, like, you know, it's always nice to have a guest on, and it adds a lot of value to the podcast, but sometimes it's just nice that the three of us kind of get to catch up. We don't see each other all the time. We don't even live in the same state, the three of us, so I'm really excited about some of the talking points I've got tonight. I think I've got some things that will even maybe stump you guys with some World War II history and just some kind of off-the-cuff type, you know, things I've come across in the past week or so. So I'm pumped to be here, guys.
Yeah, it's so good to see you guys. Lots have happened since we last all three were together. Many events, book published, all kinds of stuff to talk about. So I'm super stoked.
Before we get into all that, let's just go ahead and get this out of the way. A little local mail call for me. Got my box from Jeff. So I figured, why open it up at work when we can open up here at the show? So a little unboxing video. Yes, we do use official K-Bar knives when opening packages here at the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. Because why else would you have a K-Bar sitting on your desk? I guess to fend off intruders, but here we are. So for those of you at home, I'm unwrapping a box with bubble wrap in it. And inside is a miniature mason jar. My miniature mason jar collection is actually a miniature jelly jar, I should say. My miniature jelly jar collection is growing. Jeff and I have gotten this interest in miniature jelly jars, and you can't have a miniature jelly jar just sitting around empty, right? Who collects empty jelly jar? So Jeff goes out of his way to fill said empty jelly jars with different minerals from around the world. And today he sent me sands from Guam.
Nice.
So I will add that to the collection. I'll be sure to empty said sand out and then add this jar to my collection of empty mason jars. No, that's awesome, Jeff. Thank you so much. I'm getting a nice little collection.
Obviously, I did not get that. It was a gift to me from a really dedicated and longtime listener. Probably one of the earliest reenactors I've ever worked with. He's now serving United States Navy on the USS Teddy Roosevelt. So he was just got back from a deployment all over the Pacific, including Guam, of course. So it was really thoughtful for him to take the time to get me not just a little bit of Guam, either. Like, I got like a lot of Guam.
That sounds like a romance novel. A little bit of Guam.
I got a lot of Guam. And obviously, we know the significance of that in World War II. But just from a personal note, you know, my grandfather served in the Marine Corps just after the end of the war, right? He served from 46 to 48. And he was part of the occupation force on Guam, where he had actually been involved in a vehicle accident. He was riding in an amphibious duck, and the duck somehow veered off the road and rolled over. That was the beginning of his back troubles that he suffered for the rest of his life that conveniently he just genetically passed down to me as I injured my back in the Army and have several other similar issues that he dealt with. So it's kind of neat to have Guam, I mean, to add to the collection, of course, and what good is a gift if you're not sharing it with your friends? So I, you know, immediately had to send some to Don, and I've got some waiting for Dennis.
That's
so
awesome.
We can all just have a little bit of Guam.
It's awesome. I lived on Guam for a couple years when I was a kid and in the 70s. And evidently I had a good time, and I got my first kiss on Guam, and I would later find out my grandpa fought for Guam. He was there on a LCI gunboat taking in the underwater demolition teams and protecting them when they were doing their recon. So that's very cool, Jeff. I appreciate that. Yeah, that's special. Yeah.
It's kind of crazy how all these different beaches and sands, just everything is so, you know, you think sand is sand is sand, but it's different colors, different shade, different textures, different granulars. I mean, even here in Florida, we have what Carrie calls our sand here. She doesn't like, it's too soft. She says it's like baking flour. She's like, I like the California sand better. I'm like, I don't. That's like cat litter. So just, you know, between California and Florida, we have huge difference in sands. But yeah, it's very cool. I have to.
Well, Don, you will find, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I put that in that little jar, that sand, it acts as if it's wet.
Really?
Like, It will get on the outside of the jar. It will stick. It will hang vertically, upside down. Like, it's as if it's wet. It's almost like kinetic sand. It's so fine. Cool. But it was really strange. You'll see. I mean, it's just like you open the lid and then it just gets everywhere. But it's not like, I mean, it's dry, but it acts as if it's wet. It can just stick to stuff. It's strange.
Jeff's going to have to build a clean room just for transporting and distributing sands from around the world. Like my shirt?
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Got lucky this weekend. We had VKE and two things. Sadly, one of our long-term reenactors is slowing down. He's not getting out of the hobby, but he's slowing down and he was offloading a lot of stuff. And then another gentleman who's been doing it for 20 years, as it happens as you get older, you start gaining weight. And so he had a lot of stuff that didn't fit him. So I got a sweet Orlando Airbase shirt out of the deal, just gave it to me. And I found the postcard on the internet, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Got an early airborne non-reinforced jacket. The pants are too big for me, so I gave them to one of the Bouvet brothers who do airborne all the time. And then I got a new helmet done up in 2nd Ranger Battalion. So now when we do Ranger stuff, I have a helmet set up for that. But yeah, this weekend was 2024 VKE, which is the Von Kessinger Express. It's been going on at the Florida Railroad Museum for 20 years now. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast over the last couple of years. But this year was the first year Art Dersheimer and his wife Meg, who has been running it for about the last 7 or 8 years, has stepped down, handed the role over to Paul, and I'm Paul's secondary, so we ran it this year. Sadly, the area in which it's located is right outside of Bradenton, who suffered a lot of damage from Milton. And so we had a lot of Germans there. More Germans this year than any time. Most reenactors know when you go to an event, usually Allies outnumber the German reenactors, you know, 2-1, 2-3 sometimes. This time it was the Germans, you know, outnumbered us, but actually kind of worked well that way. Brief synopsis of the whole scenario. It's at the Florida Railroad Museum. They got about, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles of active track, and they have a train. We bolt out of there before the public gets there. They come, giant swastika flags. You've got the guys walking around in Weimar Republic. You got SS guys yelling at people, screaming at people, hurry up, get through line. And Eric Chadwick and his friend are sitting there stamping people, screaming at them and yelling at them, just being complete a-holes to them because, well, that's what Germans do. The storyline is they are...
I love it.
You're in German-occupied France. And so people... The citizen, you know, the audience comes, buy tickets. It's like being on a murder mystery train minus the murder and the mystery. And they hand out documentation. Everybody gets a passport, has their German name and the German logo on it. And they're handing out papers telling them to hide them. It's kind of a scavenger hunt to see how well the Allies do when we come on the train and take it over. You know, turns out they handed out 22 pieces of this documents. We only found 15 of them. Next year we got try harder. But it's a very cool thing. Paul took over Art's part of the skit. I took over Paul's part. And so the whole thing is there's a general on the train. We know that. We take over the train at the end of the line after a battle skirmish because the public shows up. They get yelled at, screamed at, carted on the train. As the train's going down the tracks, the Germans are yelling at them, and they got a whole thing going on, which I've never observed because I've never been on the train. They get to a midpoint halfway down. They stop, take somebody off to execute. Airborne come in. They have a skirmish. Airborne loses. Germans get back on the train. They go down the end of the line, takes more people off to neutralize, if you will. Then we come out, have a skirmish. We take over the train. And then as the train's going back, much like a performance, because that's what this is. This is less of a living history event, more of a World War II themed performance. It's kind of our way of giving back because the Railroad Museum makes a lot of the money that they operate off of the year at this particular event. And so we kind
That's
of,
cool.
It's fun for us to change things up, you know, because every lot, you know, most living history events, it's here's what it is, you know, and now it's kind of our turn to do a little improv and have some fun. And so we find the general. Paul has a conversation with him. Actually, he finds me first because I'm second lieutenant. Are you the, you know, highest ranking person on this train? No, I'm the highest ranking person on this cart. You have to deal with me. We get in an argument. I get the captain, they have a speech. Then we move down to the next car and repeat the same scene because every car, they don't hear it. And so we do that, get back to the end of the train station where they got on. We offboard the general. Imagine that. The Germans are out there in the parking lot. They want their general back. Big skirmish. It happens again. We win. Audience claps. Speech. They leave. Turn around. Do two performances on Saturday and one on Sunday. But this is the first year that Paul and I ran it. Everything worked well with the exception of we had low attendance because that local area suffered from the hurricane this year. But it still went well, and so we're looking forward to do it next year. But one of the things we noticed is a lot of our Florida reenactors are getting older. A lot of them are aging out. Sadly, we've had a few pass away this year. And it's something we don't think a lot of. The younger audience aren't in the Facebook, right? Most of the stuff is managed through Facebook and organized through Facebook. Me, Paul, and Nate, we went over to the SS camp, and we were sitting down having drinks with the head of the SS. And they had like 5 new kids there. We're like, where are you doing your recruiting from? They're like, we want old school. We got a website set up. I'm like, that makes perfect sense because young cats don't use Facebook. That's their parents' thing, right? And so we the Allies, we've got to talking about, you know, we need to start recruiting and start rebuilding the Florida numbers up. And so we're going to start focusing on that. We're going to put less emphasis on Facebook and build a website and try to start recruiting younger cats and rebuilding the Florida community. And so that's what we're going
to
focus on.
How much fun would that be, Jeff, if we could do that train from that goes from Burnett to Austin or whatever? Do something like that. That's pretty cool.
Well, let me float this by you guys. Maybe this is something that you could put a little – if you think this would be an interesting concept. So basically the museum has two properties. You got the starting point, the end point, and you turn around and go back to starting point. Well, at the end point, they just turn one of the old train cars into like – a double bathroom, one for men, one for women. It's all air conditioned. They just put a slab down and the start of a pole barn so they can start having bands and stuff play there because they do Western themed stuff and all these different things. Well, one of the things they do for Christmas and Easter is they set the end of the lineup at Santa's Workshop or Easter Bunny Land, whatever. People get on the train station, they ride down, and now they're at Santa's Workshop. I'm like, well, they got the air conditioned bathrooms now. They got this place to set up a band. Why don't we try to organize a secondary event where the audience gets on down there, they take this train ride back to 1940, and then when they get off the train, we have all the tents set up here. We have a USO show going on here. We get some local...
That'd be so freaking cool.
Get some local acting troops to do, you know, performances in their gear, have civilians walk around. And so we might try to get that up maybe another year or two. But
you guys have any big bands down there that you could have playing?
Well, they're located in Bradenton outside of Tampa, but between Tampa, Fort Myers, Bradenton, and USC, I'm sure we can find, whether it's a college band, a local high school orchestra, somebody, you know, I'm sure we can track down, you know, a group of people who knows how to play.
Yeah, you know, and there's even like the high school here at Medina Valley, Smithson Valley, or not, but Medina Valley High School, they have a big band. Part of their high school. It's a jazz band and they play big band music and they're freaking awesome.
Well, one of the things we could also do, which we used to do when we did the Georgia event, is we'd have USO show where Jeremy Petrell and the guys from Georgia, they got old Bob Hope skips and just edited them a little bit, the location to Georgia. We could do it to Paris, Florida. Paul does a great Abbott and Costello bit. And so we could do that sort of thing as well. So we're going to try to turn that into something else.
Really cool, man. Because, that is really cool.
Yeah, because we're also trying to start to rebuild the amount of shows there are. I'm not shows, but reenactments there are a year because, as we've said in the past before, ever since the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando 5-6 years back, once that happened, every state park in the state of Florida said no more weapons demo with brass cartridges. So if you're doing Civil War, Revolutionary War, Spanish-American War with black powder rifles, you can do weapons demos. But World War I, Korean World War II, no more weapons demos. And as you guys know, a lot of the time the audience, even if you're just standing there giving a demonstration, they like the this and that. And so we lost a lot of events that happened at state parks. And so now we need to start rebuilding new ones on private properties and things like that. So we're going to really focus on trying to rebuild the World War II reenacting community here in Florida.
It's pretty awesome, man. That's exciting stuff.
And I know you and Jeff got an event coming up next weekend, right?
Give us the yeah, we do. That. It's the first ever air show at the town just west of me, a little town called Llano, Texas, right on the Llano River there. Really cool little historic town with an airport. And the squadron commander of the Highland Lake Squadron here out of the CAF had since moved on, and he became the paying gig, you know, the airport manager in Llano. So when he took that position, I think over the summer, he had made the, you know, brought up to city council, hey, we need to do an air show. And he had run the air show, you know, here in Burnet for several years. And so he kind of knows the ins and outs. He's got all the contacts. So invited me to come out. Yeah, really, really pumped about that. Looks like the weather is going to finally cooperate with us. It's going to feel kind of like November. It's a combination air show and car show. So he's actually building it as Wine Wheels and Wings. They're building it around a local winery that Dennis knows really well, Seven Creeks. Seven Creeks did, they're 2 miles from my house here. They did our VIP experience for the Burnet Air Show for several years at the VIP tent. So they'll have their setup, and then there'll be, you know, some classic and muscle cars set up, and then as well as some historic aircraft coming in. I think I've got one ground act that I'm going to do. We're going to demo an M1897 trench gun and talk Marine Corps assault team during World War II and just kind of how that worked, what that looked like. And then, of course, fire the flamethrower. And then, so, you know, that's always a showstopper. And then I'm going to kind of talk about just the evolution of firearms from World War II to present day. And then we're going to tie in, there's a veteran from the what's called Centex paratroopers. These are all former airborne guys. Their chapter here in Central Texas is named after a local soldier from Llano, from that town, who was killed in action. So we're going to highlight him at the end of that little ground act. So, yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. I mean, of course, I live for air shows and getting to chat with folks, and you never know who you're going to meet, and you never know the stories that you're going to get out of them. And, you know, about their family members who served or artifacts that they may have, and kids showing interest. So I'm going to bring as much of my display as possible. I'll trailer the Jeep out there. We'll have probably, I'm asking for five, 6 foot tables to complete my Air Corps display. We'll have a couple tables full of weapons and gear for kids to try on and things like that. So, yeah, so it's been busy. Last weekend was our Pumpkins and Paratroopers that we do here at the Burnet Airport. It's a, you know, program I designed about 5 years ago to get kids involved, and we have a local grocery store donate a bunch of pumpkins, and a retired art teacher comes out and brings all the paints and the smocks and the paintbrushes, and a bunch of kids came out and got to paint pumpkins, and we had our All-American Airborne demo team that came out. They run the jump training actually out of Toccoa, Georgia. That's put several of the band actors through actual jump training.
Sure.
So getting to talk to those guys again was really cool, and just listening to what they do and how they've got a lot of the band, actors together to jump and jump into Normandy. I think they're jumping in Virginia this next coming weekend. So they're all over. They're a really cool organization to kind of partner with. So definitely be looking for some guys coming out of that to, they want to come on What's the Scuttlebutt.
Absolutely.
Talk about what they do. And yeah.
Fun little thing. Maybe you guys could email us at mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. One of the things about reenacting and living history events that happen over the weekends, if you're at the type of event where you're staying the night on site, and most guys, when you wake up, you try to have authentic breakfasts and what have you. A lot of spam and corned beef hash and black coffee. Email us some of your favorite tweaks or recipes on living history staples when it comes to tweaking meals, keeping them still semi-authentic, but change things up a little bit. One of the things I had this weekend, which I don't think I had before. Your standard fried Spam on a Hawaiian King roll with a piece of pineapple. Damn delectable. I mean, just that pineapple. I remember, not to go over the whole thing, but obviously with the layout of this particular event, we, as the ally, we have to leave early. So if the train leaves at noon, we got to bug out at 9:30, because if you have the public showing up, it kind of destroys the whole storyline. You got a bunch of guys in army outfits walking around the German-occupied France. And so we got to load up and leave like an hour and a half, 2 hours early, and go lay out in the sun down at the other end, wait for the train to come. And so a lot of times we'll eat down there, and I just took my regular can of Spam and was putting it on crackers. And some of the younger cats are like, oh, that's gross. I'm not eating uncooked Spam. I was like, Spam's cooked in the can. I mean, it's not fried, but it's cooked. And I lopped them off and put on crackers, made them eat it, and they're all decently surprised. But yeah, if email us, let us know your preferred living history weekend staples, way you touch up things, or you know, your idea of a good authentic food, and email those to us so we can maybe start combining a list and giving us new items to try out at living history events.
That's an interesting idea. And actually, on the subject of emails, I've got one I wanted to share with you guys.
Please.
Yeah, just a couple weeks ago. And I know we're beyond Halloween, but I think it's worth mentioning here on the show, because I'd love to hear some feedback from the listeners on this as well. This comes from a young listener who, him and his dad, I met more than a year ago. They're both building a Tuskegee Airmen impression. Kind of a father-son project, so it was really, really cool. So the son emailed me, reached out to me, and he said, hey, Mr. Cupp said, I want to thank you for the khaki ties. I've been helping them, you know, get some of their uniform equipment together. So you've been a massive help building this impression. And my dad finally had an excuse to teach me how to tie a tie, which I thought was pretty neat. I also wanted to ask you a question I think only you can answer. Halloween is approaching, and naturally my friends are going dressed up. Halloween isn't my thing, but spending time with friends is great, so I was considering going as a Tuskegee Airman. I wanted to ask you if that's okay, because a big part of reenacting is understanding why you're wearing the uniform and respecting its historical impact. Would it be morally wrong to wear an original World War II impression as a Halloween costume? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Thanks.
I would like to hear your thoughts on this too before you answer it, because 7 or 8 years ago when I worked at the radio station, we had to go to Halloween events, and I had the same question. It's like, is it frowned upon, especially as a non-military, active military person or retired military person in real life, is it frowned upon to wear a World War II uniform to a Halloween event? And I got an answer for someone else, but I want to hear your answer first, and we'll compare notes.
Well, so I'll just let you know what I wrote them back. I said, it's a great question, and it's one that I have been asked before. No, I don't think it's morally wrong at all, as you are still bringing awareness, which to me is the greatest way to honor their sacrifice. Since it's no longer a regulation uniform, stolen valor is irrelevant. Wear it. People will ask questions, and you'll be able to teach them. I think the boys from Tuskegee would be proud.
Heck yeah.
That's my answer to it. I'm not saying it's the right answer. Similarly, we've talked on the show here. This was years ago, but somebody had brought up, I found a World War II uniform, but it doesn't fit me. You know, what does it do to the value if I get it, you know, altered to fit me? And, you know, it was like somebody asked us how we felt about that. I think it's the same thing here. Alter it. If you're collecting it, you know, strictly for like reselling, revalue, you know, things like that, if you're interested in the value of it from a resale perspective, then great. Just preserve it. Don't jack with it. But from a reenacting standpoint, living history, you have to ask yourself, what better way are we going to honor them? Leaving something hung in a closet or covered in plastic and mothballs up in the attic? Or if it has to be altered to fit you so you can wear it and tell the story? If it were me, I would want somebody wearing my uniform. You alter, do whatever you got to do to it to keep it alive.
And most of the time when you're letting out article clothing, they're using the extra material that was built into that item that was designed to be let out, quote unquote. So, you know, even if you're altering it, usually they're using original material that came with the. Now, sometimes they might have to add some, but a lot of times, you know, they're just letting it out. So they're still they're still using the original material, so they're not truly changing the historical value because the person who got issued it in the first place had to have it go brought in. So, I mean, they were changed throughout time. Real quick on the Halloween thing, the answer was given to me by somebody, and I kind of agree with, especially when it comes to the American side, which, you know, could be a little biased on our end because we're Americans, but his whole thing was, if you want to wear your uniform, wear your uniform. I would steer away from representing, you know, goring it up. Say, oh, I'm a dead GI or I'm the zombie version of that. You know, don't Halloween the uniform. You know, if you're just going to wear the uniform and go as a, you know, a veteran, then by all means, or representation of World War II. But their advice was, you know, don't go as the zombie version, or, you know, don't horrify it up, glorify it, and turn it into a ghoul or a spectacle version of a World War II soldier. That was their
good answer.
Their take on, you know, it can be considered frowned upon if you, you know, got an eye hanging out, or you put your arm behind your back, pretend like you got blown up a landmine, then it's in poor taste. But if you're just wearing it straight like you would at a living history event, then by all means, go for it.
I agree. What do you think, Dennis?
I don't know. You guys just gave me an idea for Halloween next year. I might have to get a German uniform and dress up as a dead Nazi zombie Nazi.
Well, I was going to say that passes, though, because there was a video game called Nazi Zombies. And yeah. By the way, no one's going to get offended. You're dressed up as a dead Nazi. But yeah. So, I mean, that's.
And the show is canceled.
Can't cancel a show that has no sponsors.
Well, it was fun.
So that's the best thing about being independent. No one can pressure us for saying things that. Might be frowned upon, but yeah, you know, it's
going back to that young man there. What was his first name?
Amari.
Going back to Amari, like, kudos for even thinking at that age to even be that aware, like, and yeah, to 17. so eloquently voice, you know, we talk all the time about how the historians of the future, we feel bad for them because they're going to have to decipher LOLs and OMGs. And here this young man is proving us all wrong by this beautifully written email with great sentiment. So, yeah, just major props to Amar. That's just great. You know, to even be aware of that, you know, most kids would just plow forward. But that's pretty special. And actually, I got goosebumps. It gives me hope for the future that we got some really fine people coming up, you know.
And to Dennis's point, to have the maturity to understand that when you wear these uniforms, you're supposed to represent as if, and not, you know, regardless if it's Halloween or an event, you don't want to act a fool while wearing these uniforms. And so to be at the maturity level at his age, to even have the foresight, like Dennis suggested, to ask someone's opinion on, you know, the appropriateness of where to wear that uniform speaks.
And how cool that he gets to impression of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I remember in the ER, I'd walk in. I don't remember what the Tuskegee Airman who he was. He was a colonel, and this was even just 4 years ago. And me and Mike Talamantes would. Mike Talamantes, he's a retired first sergeant in the Army, and he'd been to Iraq and this and that. And we would come in the door and. Mike would stand at attention and he would salute and he'd call me, hey, Colonel, this is, you know, I got to come in and get some blood pressure. And he's all right, sir. And then, you know, we were just so respectful and we would call him by his title, you know, just, I was just so honored to be able to take care of him. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. I'm very glad that young man is going to go forward with him, you know, remembering those fellows. That's freaking awesome.
Well, I mean, that's the heartbeat of reenacting right there. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. That's the quintessential reenactor that you want in living history. This is not cosplay. These are not costumes. And like Don pointed out too, yeah, you don't horrify things. You don't gore it up for Halloween. Yeah, no, it definitely shows we're in the right direction with some of the stuff that we're doing. And the people that we meet because of the public events that we do. I mean, I met him essentially at an air show. So the passing of the torch to that generation isn't as It's going to be an easier transition, I think, than we realize.
You know, one
and
of
we
the
give the younger generation credit for.
And Don, are you seeing that down there in Florida? I know I was really super, really happy being at these events with Jeff tagging along, that seeing these young people, and, you know, with the exception of one young man I'm thinking in particular, but most of these kids are really squared away with their uniforms, and they can tell they put a lot of care into it, and they're very respectful. Is it the same way? Are you seeing that down there in Florida?
Yeah. It was interesting. We were having a conversation about this weekend, because once again, we're talking about recruiting. And a majority of reenactors don't get started until they're in their late 20s, or early 30s, because they start having more expendable income. That's usually when young males start to gain an interest in history versus, you know, there are some younger kids who do get, who have a desire to get into it, but because of the financial hurdle, some parents are more reluctant because they've already been down this road when he wanted to play hockey, football, this and that, and they're just tired of buying different uniforms at different prices.
For sure.
And so, but yeah, the ones who do get into it and who do, whether they fall in it with a group that helps them out and then they slowly build up their stuff, or, you know, they work and just outfit themselves, I do find that the younger kids who come by their uniform a little more harder than someone who's in their 30s who has expendable money, then it's just, okay, it's just another purchase. To your point, I do find that they put more interest and effort in having the uniforms more squared away. I do see more sloppy late 20, early 30s guys, because they're just, you know, they're just go on a website and buy bulk stuff and then show up, whereas the younger cats, and plus a lot more younger kids have more free time and really interest in this stuff. So yeah, I do see it, and it's a nice thing to see. And to that point, I half-heartedly jokingly put up a TikTok about it this weekend, but one of the things I often think about that I don't think the general public thinks about, and why would they, when it comes to these younger gentlemen, you know, the 15-year-olds, 16, 17-year-olds, especially here in Florida, it's probably different out there in Texas for you guys, because you're in a more rural spread out area and you have the culture of outdoors and, you know, the whole lifestyle of Texas versus a kid who lives in downtown Orlando, Tampa, or Miami. They come to these events, especially the ones that take 3 days. I literally taught a kid how to build a fire this weekend. I got there and because the mosquitoes were bad, he has been struggling trying to get this bonfire lit. And I walked over there and showed him how to do it. And then Jeremy got a fire starter and we built the teepee, the whole normal stuff, which was common for us. And we got it lit. And then I watched him sit there and kick it and play with it and add, you know, everybody does when they first learn how to build their first fire. You know, you jokingly say the biggest mistake people make when they start barbecuing their food is they don't leave their meat alone, right? They're constantly flipping it and pressing. It's like, no, you let it cook, then you flip it once. Young kids the same way when they build their first fire, they're constantly just poking at sticks and just constantly manipulating it. But yeah, a lot of these kids, you know, we teach them how to do their, kind of like the Boy Scouts would. We're almost like their replacement Boy Scouts. We're teaching them how to build fires. We're teaching them how to set up tents. We're teaching them how to use K-bars without cutting their fingers off. And a lot of these kids, you know, especially nowadays with how sensitive the environments are that they're in, they kind of get their childhood hazing from us, the older guys at the event. You know, we jokingly bust our balls, you know, hey, new guy, go do this and that. We kind of give them that little old school ball busting that we all got from our brothers and our cousins growing up. You know, you not only are we taking them away from their cell phones, but they're actually starting to get a little rousing. And by the second or third event, they're starting to give it back. You're like, that's what we want. You got to give it back. And they're kind of almost getting something more out of the event than just the history side. They're learning things. Once again, building bonfires, how to set up a camp, getting comfortable sleeping outside for 3 days, sleeping with mosquitoes and all that stuff. And so I think they're, along with the history, I think people get a lot more out of living history, whether it's Civil War, World War II, whatever it may be, just getting outside. You know, I think it's a great reset. You know, I left work Friday. I was outside. I was outside from Friday 5 p.m. until Sunday 5 p.m. I was outside for 3 days straight, you know, with the exception of the 45 minutes we're inside of a train, we were either, you know, we were out in the sun or out in the dark all night, all weekend long. And it's, you know, I'm a little beat up and sore, but it's a great recharge. It just,
that's cool.
3 days. Yeah. I have a phone in my pocket. I wasn't texting anybody. I wasn't watching YouTube videos. I'd pull it out long enough to take photos. But other than that, it was in my bag all weekend. So just, you know, being around fire, eating crappy food and just busting people's balls and talking. And as we all do at Living History events, especially on private properties around, you know, public's gone away. You've been out there all weekend. You start drinking and just sharing memories and having good times.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, you never know what could happen at a Living History event. I recently got invited to a wedding, actually to be a groomsman in the wedding for two of my former reenactors from the Nimitz. He had been there for before me. He'd been there for a while and came up in it as a teen, and then ended up joining the Army. And he's an active duty lieutenant in the Army now. And we, you know, over the tenure that I was there, about 5 years, we recruited quite a few females to come in and do, and you know, Don, you participated, you saw the whole nine yards, all the representations of women in the military, women at home, and you know, everything that they did and the presentations that they put together. And one of them, you know, one of those ladies, just I guess kind of they got sweet on each other, and over the years they've been together, and here we go, and they're gonna get married down there. You know, at the museum, cool. Which I think is super cool, in the Nimitz Ballroom.
So cool.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you never know. You never know what could happen.
It'll this marks my 10th anniversary, and for the first time in my Living History experience, I too, the wedding's not until 2026, which is great, gives people plenty of time to plan, but they're doing a military, you know, if you're modern-day military, by all means, wear your, you know, active military, wear your Class A's. If not, wear your Living History Class A's. His wife's down for the cause, and that's in 2026. Here's a fun thing to do, speaking of busting balls. So as I said, today, this year was Paul and mine's first. Give Paul the credit. He did majority of this stuff, but I helped him out. And so when our guys are going through the audience collecting these documentations in German, you know, all in German, one of my sergeants said, Lieutenant, you may want to read this. He flipped it over. One of the German reenactors, "Dear Paul, I'm so happy that we get to spend this time together. It's long lost time that we can finally rekindle a relationship and get married. Love, Don A." So they wrote a fake letter from me to Paul and handed it out, and had one of the wives kiss it. And, you know, so here I am on this stage running by people, and I find a love letter allegedly written from me to Paul talking about how we finally get to share our love with the reenacting community. And that's something I've had happen, not that, but here's a great thing. If you guys are listening at home and you're trying to figure out how to add a little more fun to your Living History weekend, especially if you have, maybe it's your wife, your kid, you know, a friend of yours who has a enjoyment for writing, write letters. We do this occasionally. Someone will call mail, call anybody surprised, and Mark, you'll get a real letter addressed to you. And it could be anything from, you know, grandmother passed away to, hey, Dear John letters are quite popular. Or one letter was, you know, your brother's writing you to say that, you know, turns out your wife cheated on it. Just all, some are funny, some are sad, but just little things like that. And then your guys can put them in their helmets. Brent got a letter this weekend from his girlfriend from home, who's working in the part of the civilian defense. And we've all seen that famous picture of the younger girls look like they're in a high school hallway with the rifle, for doing rifle training. Well, whoever wrote the letter made up this 4-paragraph page, how they're doing their part to help protect the home front. And there's a photo of me and my friend. And so now Brent has this handwritten letter with a photo of these two girls he can keep inside his helmet and things like that. And so little things like that, if you know somebody who enjoys writing letters, type it up on a typewriter or write it if they have pretty cursive or whatever, you can do all kinds of fun things like that. And it catches the reenact. They're not expecting it. And it's something you can do as a unit commander or, you know, a platoon sergeant to help liven things up and to just give that little bit of extra fun and authenticity.
Yeah, it's cool. Those little things that definitely sometimes become a big thing.
This episode brought to you in part by our friends over at 1791 Everyday Carry. Whether you're looking for a holster to home your favorite multi-tool, regardless if you're working on cars, motorcycles, working on a ranch, in a wood shop, 1791 Everyday Carry Tool Organizers allow you to carry those bulky tools in a streamlined way. Just because you like to be prepared doesn't mean it has to affect your style. With 1791 Everyday Carry leather products, you can be prepared without looking disheveled. Discover more about the 1791 Everyday Carry products. Simply visit d-410.com/1791.
Right, and I just recently found that out, and you guys are aware I sent you pictures. But so recently at an event, there was a 1943 GPW Jeep there, and the combat Jeep, right? It's over in Europe. It's full of dust, and it's got the radio mounts, and it's got the machine gun mounts, and the musette bags, and the whole nine yards, right? Like the quintessential combat Jeep on patrol in occupied France. And I've known this guy for several years, and I'd seen his Jeep several times, but never really paid attention to some of these little details, these little, I don't want to call them idiosyncrasies, but some of these little things that just make them unique and have a story. And lo and behold, he's sitting in the Jeep, and we're talking, and I just notice a Coca-Cola bottle opener bolted to his Jeep. And I said, "What's that?" And he goes and tells me this whole story. And he said, "Oh, yeah, man." He said, "There's all kinds of information online." He said, "Sometimes you saw him up here. Sometimes you saw him on the outside of the vehicle." And I'm thinking, how did this, like, I've never heard of this. So, started doing a little research. I've got a really large, thick, like, encyclopedic-type book on the Jeep, the history of the Jeep, Willys and Ford. And all the different, you know, ways that they were used, and photographs from training and in combat and lend lease and all over, and then post-war and so on. And I didn't really see anything in there on that. So I'm like, okay, this is not like mainstream. So I went to the internet I sent a message to a fellow reenactor buddy of mine who does a lot of really great Air Corps stuff. He's got a 45 GPW. He goes, "Oh, yeah." And I got one on the back of mine, right above the left bumperette. And I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." He said, "Man," he said, "they're more common than people realize.
They're usually painted the same color green, so you don't notice them in a lot of the photos."
Okay, yeah. So I even came across that. So that would be after the Jeep was probably repainted, either repurposed or for whatever reason, because I even asked my dad, because even being the National Guard in the 60s, they still had some old quarter tons. He goes, "Oh, yeah." He said, "They were mounted on the outside." But he said the same thing. They had been, you know, sprayed over OD. But he said, "Yeah." He said, "I remember being on the outside of the Jeep." And I thought, okay, now I'm hooked. Now I got to get one. So if you got a World War II Jeep, or you have a military vehicle, and, you know, you're looking for one of those little neat little, like, conversation pieces, get you an Enjoy Coca-Cola. It's got to be an original one, right? It's got to be stamped star with two A's or two R's maybe. And it's a really good, and they're out there. Some of them are pretty pricey. I found mine for a very affordable price. Mine probably dates to the 60s. I don't think it goes back to the 40s, but that'll be our secret.
Well, that's why I'm drinking this bottle, because I got extra bottles left over from this weekend. But yeah, I remember, God, 5 or 6 years ago, we were doing a Marine Corps event out at an air show, and we were being authentic. And so we would leave, obviously, modern day food wrappers we would pick up. But yeah, Mike had one in his truck. So he had bottle caps all over his floorboards. You walk around the tents, there's just Coke bottles laying on the ground, and bottle caps and cigarette butts and, you know, K ration wrappings and, you know, stuff like that, because if you're out in the field in a foxhole, there's no trash can to put all your crap in, you know. So yeah, so that's why I'm drinking these, because I got a few of these left over from this weekend. Another fun thing to do as a living historian, especially if you're not in a super hot area, or if you have a cooler stash somewhere, to engage little kids, it's the packaging won't be, unless you go that far out, but one of the things a lot of reenactors do, they'll keep a box of those little green army men. Like, they'll be going through an antique store, you can see them, you know, grab a handful for 50 cents, and they'll just load up on those and give out to kids, and then Hershey bars, you know, give them Hershey bars and all that. And as you're talking to them and explain the importance of, you know, Coca-Cola, and don't really get into the cigarette talk so much, but you talk about how the soldiers are given Coca-Cola and candy bars and things like that. And yeah, those are all little things you can do to engage the audience. Here's another perfect thing, right? So Jeremy knew that one of the things we do every year is try to coax people to give up this paperwork. Jeremy took upon himself. He went out, found images of what French money looked like back then, and he printed up stacks and stacks of French money. So he disputed all of us, and so we're going to train. You sure you don't have any paper? Pull out. You sure you don't have any paperwork? So we're like bribing people with this fake French money to get this paperwork because we knew there was a ransom on it, and how well we did recovering all this hidden paperwork, you know. So just things like that. And we had one guy walking around the French to English translation book and talk, because they're all supposed to be French, you know, civilians. And so, yeah, just all that stuff. It all helps and makes it more enjoyable.
Very cool.
Absolutely. So I got a little tidbit of information today, guys. Uh-huh. And I've been excited to share it with you.
Sure, let's hear it.
So one of my colleagues brought this to my attention first thing this morning. It was a professional development day. We didn't have students. And they're like, all right, Jeff, we got a World War II thing for you. Let's see if you've ever heard of this. And, man, they stumped me. I had never heard of this. So I'm curious if you guys have. And I thought about holding off till December because obviously we'll talk a lot more about Pearl Harbor. But there was an Operation K, that was the second attack on Pearl Harbor that happened on the 4th of March, 1942. Are you guys aware of this?
I probably would be aware of this in another 2 weeks because I'm reading that Pearl Harbor book, which is very cool because they're talking to the Marines that were stationed over here, and basically 25 different veterans. But I had to put that on hold, and when we get into what you're reading tonight, I put that on hold for the book I'm currently reading. But I bet you if I got to the end of that book, I probably would know. I just haven't gotten to that part of the timeline yet.
Well, yeah, let me know if it's in that book because I've read some of the best stuff written about the attack at Pearl Harbor. Never come across this. And the idea even as early as January, the Japanese were sending submarines trying to get, basically they were just trying to get intel. They were reconning what our recovery efforts were looking like, right? But still, they wanted these carriers that were not there at the time, right? So that was still a big push. So Operation K was designed to send five the big four-engine Kumanishi flying boats, that codename Emily. It was five Emilys that I think they took on from the Marshals, and they had to refuel at the French frigate Shoals. Weather was not very good. I think three of them never found French frigate Shoals. They got lost. So there was only two of these flying boats left. They refueled. There was a submarine there on hand that was supposed to kind of help spot them on their way to Oahu. Weather socked them in again, so they were basically flying in blind. And this is the 4th of March, 1942. So these two lone Emily Kiwanishi flying boats with a very small payload are heading towards Pearl Harbor for this other attack, Operation K. And, of course, you know, the paranoia, as you can imagine, at Pearl after December 7th, I mean, we know about our own SPDs taking, you know, friendly fire, essentially, because
four planes got shot down that
exactly.
night. I didn't learn that until I was reading this book. Later on that night, after the second wave finished, six planes came in. We shot down four of them.
Yeah, they were coming in from the Enterprise. Yeah. So, anyway, so these two are on their way, and they get picked up on radar, and they scramble some P-40s, and one of them drops their bomb early, and I want to say it was something like, now let me get the statistics here, because there's a really good article on World War II Museum's website, the National World War II Museum. Let's see. So one released their bomb about 8 miles from the target. It came down on the slopes of Tantalus Peak, narrowly missing Honolulu's Roosevelt High School. The detonation, striking the ground 900 feet away, shattered the windows in the Spanish mission-style school building. Avoiding the searching P-40s, the flying boats headed back towards the marshals with nothing to show for their work but the knowledge that the Japanese flyers had participated in the longest bombing mission in the history up to that point. American forces soon figured out the logistics of the convoluted Japanese attack, and near the end of May 1942, when conditions were right for another sortie, the Emily flying boats were scheduled to be back in the skies. Their primary mission was to snoop on the American carriers, guaranteeing they were docked at Pearl Harbor as the Imperial Japanese Navy conducted their takeover of Midway Atoll. When a Japanese submarine scrutinized French frigate shoals in preparation for a fueling rendezvous, the crew found many areas mined by the Americans, and then they spotted a pair of U.S. Navy fighting vessels awaiting their arrival. The jig was up. As a result, the second Operation K mission was aborted before it even began. The whereabouts of the U.S. Navy carrier forces would remain a mystery until they were spotted by a scout plane from the Japanese cruiser Tone 5 days later in the vicinity of Midway. So, did not know that there was even a second attack at all on Pearl. And interestingly enough, after this rabbit hole, I came across the fact that the Japanese had three submarine aircraft carriers. Let that sink in. The one was the I-400, and you can look that up. The I-400, if you're not aware of the Japanese having submersible aircraft carriers during World War II, you're going to have your mind blown. I think they could only hold five or six aircraft, but they had a watertight hangar. And at the time, it was the largest submarine in history. And the dimensions were not surpassed until the 1960s.
Wow.
To have a submarine that was larger than these. And they built three of them.
Jeez.
And yeah, and they would submerge with a watertight hangar. It was over 100 feet long. And that's where the aircraft were kept. And then they would surface, and they could launch their aircraft. Now, it was a specific type, and I'm trying to remember the model. It was a specific type of air. They're not launching Vals and Kate torpedo bombers and Mitsubishi, you know, Zeeks, but it was a specific type of smaller fighter. But still, that's interesting. Now, yeah, they did not survive. After Japan's, in 1945, the Russians were really interested in these submersible aircraft carriers. Of course, we're still suspicious of the Russians, so we scuttled all three.
You know,
we scuttled all three of these.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia for this Operation K, and to Jeff's point about not knowing about it, it looks like a lot of the reference material, a lot of the books, didn't come out until the early and mid-2000s, with the exception of one book by David D. Lohman called Rendezvous in Reverse. It came out in 1983. But other source materials show... by Rich Rudnick, came out in 2005, Hawaii's Forgotten History, The Good, The Bad, The Embarrassing. And then Steve Horn put out a book in 2005 called The Second Attack on Pearl Harbor, Operation K and Other Japanese Attempts to Bomb America in World War II.
Yeah, I never knew about that.
And then another book came out in 2016. So for whatever reason, it looks like this Operation K didn't really get a whole wide press or, you know, a lot of coverage until the early to mid 2000s. There's another book. So most of the references for this particular operation, a lot of that reference materials, well, came out in the early 2000s.
Yeah, and the article that I found on National World War II Museum's website was published November of 21.
I wonder if maybe the Japanese government had their own version of a freedom of information request, and they just started opening up some old files, and somebody came across this. Or I don't know. It's just weird that.
Yeah, well,
it's weird that
if any of our listeners know anything more about it, or you know, are we being misled in some way? Has some of this stuff been debunked? I'd like to know. Inquiring minds want to know.
You know what I would like to know, Jeff? What you reading?
I'm going to save some of those surprises for Dennis. So, because I know he's got some stuff to talk about there, but I am reading a classic book, and if you don't mind, I'd like to read a little bit of the introduction to you guys.
Sure.
I'm sure you're familiar with it. You may have had to watch this movie in middle school. Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, complete and unabridged.
Yeah.
So, but the introduction is really neat. It's very short, but it really speaks volumes. It says that it's impossible for a combat veteran to read a war novel without checking it against his own experience. I remember liking The Red Badge of Courage in high school, but now picked it up with some trepidation, hoping I would still like it 20 years later, with one of those years having been spent fighting in the Vietnam jungle. I shouldn't have worried. The book deserves its enduring reputation. Crane may never have seen battle at the time of writing Red Badge, but he knew well the interior of his own skull, and he knew that that's where true terrors reside, for everybody, soldier or not. The 100 years that passed between Chancellorsville and Vietnam brought profound changes in the machines we use to make war and the reasons our governments used to justify the abomination. But the mind and spirit that faces fire and will either fight or not is exactly the same. An interesting difference between the two wars, and a huge difference in terms of the kinds of stories you could write about them, is that soldiers on both sides of the Civil War had the option of running away. This obsesses Crane's Private Fleming at the beginning of the book, and is a recurrent concern throughout it. In the Vietnam jungle, that wasn't an option. We usually rode into battle in helicopters and had to stay there and fight until the helicopters came back. It was understood that anyone who tried to run away would be captured or died in the jungle. So failure of nerve took different forms. He goes on talking a little bit more about his time in Vietnam, but he says, most of the people in Red Badge are quite familiar. I think they would be familiar to most soldiers since armies seem to love cliches, the rumor spreaders, the strutting phonies, the officers who think they are bulletproof and expect you to stand up and be as crazy as they are, the thinkers, the jokers, the boys who love to kill, and the ones who can't. I suspect they all fought at Valley Forge, as well as Chancellorsville and Khe Sanh, and they'll all be there for roll call the next time. Crane might have heard about these types of people when he interviewed the Civil War veterans in Virginia, but I suspect most of them came from his precise instincts about human nature. Whatever the source, the power of the book is unmistakable. Any veteran who reads it sees ghosts.
Dang.
Red Badge of Courage.
It's a great quote.
Wow.
Now, before I ask Dennis what he's reading, I can see what he's wearing. And for those of you who might see this video later down the road after I get around to editing it, Dennis is wearing one of the What's the Scuttlebutt ball caps, and you can get yourself one. Or more importantly, because it's getting to be that time of year, the What's the Scuttlebutt knit caps are out. The What's the Scuttlebutt hooded sweatshirts are available. Head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the merch link. And get yourself a knit hat or a baseball cap or a hooded sweatshirt. October is now over. We're going to do the drawing for the Patreon prize pack winner on the What's in Your Head podcast this week, and we will post the name on Patreon. And so if you're signed up for that, listen there. And then starting on next week's episode, Jeff is going to explain the next giveaway we're going to do, which we're very excited for. And you guys will probably be aware of that because as we do at the other one, we're going to promote it on all of our social media pages. And so the next Patreon prize giveaway will be coming up here on the next week's episode. Actually, following next week's episode, I'll get into a little bit, but I think next week's episode is going to be a one-on-one interview with me and an author, but we'll get that momentarily. Dennis, what you reading?
Well, before I talk about my book,
please,
which we've been alluded to several times in bad podcast episodes in the past, but actually something that I am reading that I wanted to talk about first is this book that I picked up at an antique shop called Accidental Journey, a Cambridge internee's memoir of World War II by Mark Linton. In the foreword, he says, and I just love this. I just love it. P.G. Wodehouse once spoke of an author who told all about how and why he wrote his book when a simple apology would have been sufficient. So great. he says, Prologue. It's June 1945, and the grand place in Brussels lies in brilliant sunshine. Several hundred British officers, members of Montgomery's victorious 21st Army Group, are being inspected by King George VI. Wearing full field marshal's regalia, he slowly walks along the ranks of rigidly still figures and every so often pauses and speaks briefly to officers whom he appears to recognize. Thus, he stops in front of Captain Linton, 3rd Royal Tanks, and says haltingly, as was his fashion, "I have seen you before, have I not?" Stock still and looking straight ahead as prescribed in the manual, Captain Linton replies, "Respect. No, sir." The king looks at me for a very long moment and then moves on down the line. It so happens that he was right. And how and why we met before and all that occurred before and since make up this story. And then he begins the first line, which is the biggest hook in history. "I was born Max Otto Ludwig Lowenstein in Stuttgart, Germany." Oh, man, it's so good. Oh, man, it's so good.
It's reminiscent of the opening scene of The Jerk.
That's so great. Yeah, so, you know, a lot of work goes into getting a book done, obviously, and otherwise everybody would be doing it if it was easy. Something that I have been talking about a long time that's been very heavy on my heart is that I wanted to do something that I could possibly reach those folks who are very interested in history, but they just don't have the time to invest in a 350-page book, right? So I got this idea to do these short stories that could be completed in a night. Would be written hopefully in a compelling way and that would stay with folks and give them a really quick immersion, but not just dunk them in and leave them and then bring them out, but dunk them in and keep them submerged for a good while and just let them really be in that environment for a good piece and hit them with lefts and rights and stay after it and then bring them out. And they set the book down, having completed it in one or two sittings. And reviews thus far, it's been out now about a week and a half, 2 weeks. I've got about 3-4 reviews that have come in so far since it's gone out. And that's what's happened. Folks are sitting down. One lady, she messaged me that she intended just to flip through it when it first arrived. And she was immediately hooked and just completed it. And just sat down and couldn't stop. And it's staying with them. And so the idea for these books is, and Jeff actually gave me the title of the series, which everybody absolutely loves. It's called the Valor Vault series. And book one is called Bonsai Cliff, Desperation's Edge. And it's about Saipan, the suicide cliffs. And it's told from the perspective of the sailors that I interviewed, and what I do in the back is I list all the sources. So there, you'll see that there's about 12, 13 people that I interviewed, 04, 05 and beyond, LCI gunboat sailors that were there along the cliffs with the interpreters, with the bullhorns. I've got the perspective from the soldiers, and Jeff's holding up the cover of the book there for those that will see it on the video. And, the sailors, soldiers, Marines. I got some war correspondent perspectives, and of course, civilians, Chamorros, and the Japanese citizens that were there. And I'm very proud of it because I put a lot into it, and it's something that I was sure to make sure that Dan King, who we had on the podcast several episodes back, yeah, Jeff's holding up some more photographs there, some artwork that I commissioned. There's about, including the cover, which I, an artist from the country of Georgia did the cover. It directly, you'll understand the cover once you finish the book in the epilogue. You'll understand that if you zoom in and you really look at the cover, you're going to see some haunting images in the cliffs. And it'll make sense once you finish. But the artwork that's inside was all from folks that I commissioned on Fiverr.com. Nice plug for them. And Rudo Pier was a guy that I got. He was from Slovakia. He did a bunch of those pieces. My cousin Clarice, she did one. This gentleman from Georgia did the cover, and it's just absolutely stunning work. But you know, I edited it about 12, 13 times, the rewrites and this and that. And Jeff and Tammy were, did one of the very first, versions of it. And then Don, you helped out. And then Jeff helped out there with, one of the latter versions again. And, I'm very proud of it. I'm thinking folks are going to like it. That's the way I'm getting back anyway, the reviews.
And if you head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, that's WTSPWWII.com. It's currently the second post on our homepage. By the time you hear this episode, it'll be the third post down. So scroll down to the third post. You'll see the book cover, and there's a link to Amazon. That'll get you the book, and that'll also... The way Amazon works is only what people who can review said item they purchases through a legit purchase. So once you purchase it on Amazon, please go back and leave a review. However, I have a question for Dennis. I know with your previous book, Clear, you sold it on Amazon, but you also offered a portal for people to purchase it directly from you so that you could autograph copies and send it to them. Is that an option for this book as well?
Sure. I have a website that you guys actually can look at. It's under construction still, but there's a lot there to it now. It's called blockerbooks.com, and you can go on there and you'll see the four books that I, in particular, that I have personally published with two with my dad about his war dogs with him in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. My book, Clear, and then this first book of the series. Yeah, so you can go on there. You can subscribe to the email content. You'll get updates. There's blogs from different projects that I'm working on for the next several series. I'm very serious about it, and I've got very in-depth research going on, three or four projects already for the series, and I've got emails out, and folks have been sending me pictures and letters and documents and diary entries and all that already for these next series, and I'm really super excited about book two. Is really going to blow people away. And then book three is going to take it to a whole nother perspective of World War II that a lot of folks hadn't thought about. And then I've got four and five lined up as well. So it's pretty exciting. Also, you know, you can even on, there's a lot of my social media links on the blockerbooks.com. Yeah. If you want to get a signed copy and maybe you want to make it a gift for anybody, any of the books, you can message me on Facebook, Instant Messenger, send me an email, or contact us through the podcast site, and we'll just set it up. You can Venmo me, and then we'll get all the rest of that worked out.
Yeah, you can email us at mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com, and I will forward that over to Dennis.
What's really exciting, and Don, is that like, and Jeff, Jeff and I had talked about this a lot, was what I wanted to do is I wanted to take those folks that if it had been any other time, they would have been on the front page of their hometown newspaper, or they would have been on the front page of something that had happened to them, but they were overshadowed by MacArthur or Eisenhower or Patton or what the Stalin was doing or Churchill or D-Day. And so their stories were pushed further and further back as the week went along. And they're next thing you know, they're on page eight, they're on page nine, if they get there at all. And their sacrifice was just as real. And some of these folks were just as dead doing what they were trying to do and what they did as the fellows who hit Omaha Beach. And so that's what I want to do with this series. And I'm really excited. What's really exciting, fellas, is when you get reviews from the ladies, right? And they're not particularly, you know, interested, but they hear about it. And so that's what's really exciting. That's where I know that I think I might've struck a chord, because I'm getting a bunch of reviews from the ladies. So that's good.
No, it's a well-written book. I know during the preview period that I contributed to, I read through it twice And so it is a quick read as you promote it, and it's a very good read where you don't want to stop reading it once you start. This episode is brought to you by our friends over at Fume. Fume cartridges are crafted from medical-grade polyester designed for use with essential oils. Fume, a non-vape, non-nicotine, non-tobacco device, works by replacing the hand-to-mouth fixation, calming nervous tension through fidgeting, and distracts you from the bad habits with delicious flavors. Psychologists have shown stopping a bad habit cold turkey is very hard for your brain. The Fume handheld device has a built-in fidget, also has a weight similar to most vape pens. If you're interested in replacing old bad habits with new good habits, head on over to tryfume.com/D410M and get yourself a free pack of toppers with your purchase. The toppers is a perfect new accessory designed with your comfort in mind. Slip it onto the mouthpiece for a softer, warmer feel. So replace those old habits with a new habit, a good habit. Simply go to tryfume.com/D410M. That's tryfume.com/D410M. So what I'm reading is a book called The Forbidden Garden, The Botanist of the Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice by Simon Parkins, who will be on the episode next week. We had to change up our schedule due to him being in the United Kingdom. But an interesting thing about this book, you would never think the first nation, the first continent, the first government, the first group of people to actually consider the importance of a seed bank was Russia. And so here's just a brief synopsis about this particular book. It's a very, very interesting book. From the award-winning author of The Island of the Extraordinary Captives, the riveting, untold, true story of the botanist of the world's first seed bank who faced impossible choice during the siege of Leningrad, eat the collection to prevent starvation or protect their life's work and help end world hunger. In the summer 1941, German troops surround the Russian city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and the beginning of the longest blockade in recorded history, one that would ultimately claim lives of nearly 750,000 people. At the center of the besieged city stood a converted palace that housed the world's largest collections of seeds, more than 250,000 samples of hand-collected over two decades from all over the globe by world-famous explorer, geneticist, and descendant of Nikolai Volovov, who had recently been disappeared by the Soviet government. After attempts to evacuate the priceless collection failed and supplies dwindling among the 3 million starving citizens, the employees of the Plant Institute were left with a terrible choice. Should they save the collection or feed themselves? And so it's a very interesting book about, A, you learn a lot about the siege around Leningrad, but once again, just the idea that these botanists decided even before the war that the need to collect all the available seeds throughout the world in an effort to, and we're kind of seeing this now in modern day terms. It's crazy to think 90 years later, we're still doing the same thing where they're trying to take all these different seeds and come up with a way to find a cure for world starvation. And so that's where the seed bank originally came from. And now they find themselves surrounded by, you know, the Germans, and what do we do with this 20 years worth of collection? And so it's a very, very interesting book, and you can tell by the way Simon writes about it. If he's not a botanist at heart himself, he definitely took a long interest in it, because it's not just, you know, they get into some pretty interesting detail about how all this stuff went down. And so I'm very interested in talking to him. And then once I finish that book, I'll go back to finishing up my Pearl Harbor book. And as a side note, I can't remember the last time I've read three books simultaneously. Not World War II related, but I'm also reading George Orwell's 1985. Interesting fact about that book. In the past, I've read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And the interesting thing about those two books is the authors both lived through World War II and being over on the other side of the pond. And it's interesting how these two authors who lived through those battles took their experiences and what they saw historically and then created fiction, historical fiction books based on the lessons they learned about communism and socialism and overbearing governments in World War II to create these fictional environments but have some real-world experiences and warning signs in them, and how they could kind of be applied or at least looked at different times and say, that sounds familiar. Well, I think we saw that last week. And so it's very interesting One, when I read Atlas Shrugged back in the early 2000s, and now I'm reading 1985. So those are the three books I'm currently reading, the Pearl Harbor, Survivors, The Forbidden Garden, and 1985.
And, well, you know, we've talked several times about the importance of pre-World War II so we can understand World War II, especially the First World War. And your Forbidden Garden, it comes as no surprise at all, because that was really – that's what pushed Russia out of the First World War. You know, they were absolutely – starving to death, the public in general, just the Russian population. So when the Bolsheviks took power, that was their big promise to the Russian people: we're gonna sign a ceasefire with Germany, because they could not maintain the war effort as well as feeding people back home. They were physically starving. So it's interesting they, you know, are taking what they learned from that First World War and having to implement it in the early parts of the Second.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring that up, because they kind of talk about how the seed collection started near the end, you know, the ending of that revolution, and then how when the Bolsheviks took over, how their funding got cut, right? Because you have people saying, you know, the government's providing funding for you guys to travel around the world. It's just a way to disguise your desire for leisure travel to collect these pointless seeds, and what a huge waste of money. We could be allocating that money to this and that. And so even before being surrounded by the Germans, they were kind of fighting off internally the lack of funding and, you know, the new uprise and change of opinion on things as far as what's considered important and what's not. And so you got all these different layers to what these guys are trying to do to accomplish their not only desire, but what they believe to be their purpose in life, to help come up with a way to end starvation through gene splicing different plants, and not even so much gene splicing plants, but trying to find the perfect seed that can survive in different weather and different environments, and things that can be sent to different continents to help feed their communities and their population, all while dealing with the internal struggles of what's going on in Russia and then the world outside, and then, you know, Germany breaking their peace pact, and now they're dealing with all this. And so it's just all these different struggles and that the small ragtag group. And it's kind of interesting, the head of this idea that started, he was already in his late 30s, early 40s. And as oftentimes happens, when you have a adventure, a project this big and this outlandish, more often than not, if you want it to succeed, you almost have to, and you definitely do, benefit by bringing in younger cats, right? People who don't have families and wives and all that. So he's in his 30s, late 40s, but a lot of his rising stars, if you will, they're college students. And so they're all trying to travel around the world and get this stuff done, all while protecting, you know, the group of Russia that would later become the KGB. You know, these guys are traveling around the world. Are they collecting seeds or are they spies? And so, you know, every little corner, what these guys were put through in an effort to achieve their goal and what they felt their life work was to collect these different seeds, catalog them, and try to feed the world. They have to deal with all the different opinions and suspicions and paranoias of outside world and try to do that with literally World War II going on. It's just, it's a very interesting and courageous read what these guys went through. And so that, we'll go in more detail on that next week. Anything else you guys want to plug or get in before we wrap up this episode?
Congrats to Dennis on your latest publication. Just big congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We're very proud of you.
Appreciate y'all's help.
We'll send you pictures from Lano Air Show.
Looking forward to it. And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. For myself, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker Jr., we'll talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.